Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly podcast about agriculture and medicine with an emphasis on biotechnology and the good things we can do for people and the planet. My name's Kevin Folta. I'm a professor at the University of Florida, one of your top 10 public universities. All right, we're going to talk today about oil, cooking oil, in particular, Plenish soybean oil. Now, over the years, we've had a lot of discussion about the different kinds of oils that are used either as cooking, I guess you would say substrates, you know, frying your fries or cooking in recipes, but also the oils that are used as food ingredients. And we've seen a lot of radical changes since the 1970s. I can remember talking about saturated fat and unsaturated fat and one that's good for you and one that's bad for you, all that kind of rhetoric. And in late 1980s, I was introduced to canola oil, which apparently had a higher monounsaturated profile and less saturated fat. And it really started to show after that a lot of change in the ways that oils were being marketed and the ways that consumers were seeking out oils. Now, in the last couple of years, we've heard a lot about trans fats and heard a lot about the other types of modifications that have been made chemically to the oil molecules that render them more stable for cooking or maybe as ingredients, but maybe not be the best for human health. Nowadays, it's possible to use genetic engineering to change the plants to have more healthful oil profiles. And today I'm speaking with Kim Nill, Director of Market Development for the Minnesota Soybean Research and Development Council in Minnesota. Welcome to the podcast, Kim.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate you being on. I had the opportunity to engage someone from your organization a few weeks ago online and really realized, well, I mentioned my favorite oil is WD-40 or Castrol synthetic. And they said, we have to send you some Plenish. And I, you know, it was surprising to me because I've heard a lot about Plenish over the years, but actually never actually had a chance to try it or didn't know of its current status. So this is really great that we have time to talk. So when we look at the major plant-derived oils, what are the major ones that are currently being used in food preparation?
Worldwide, the two largest oils used for food preparation are soybean oil and palm oil. Other oils in the list would be corn oil, canola oil, sunflower oil, and olive oil.
Okay, olive oil. And then there was also like safflower, which seemed to have come and gone. But then a lot of folks, of course, still cook with peanut oil, which is interesting. But nowadays, this huge, anytime you bring up oil, people say, what about coconut oil? Which seemed to be one that years ago was one that they wanted us to get away from. And is that still something that's available or being used in a broader context?
Yes, and depending on the country that you're referring to, you're right. Those lesser oils you mentioned would actually be major oils in some of them. So in the Philippines, coconut oil would be far more commonly used than in America. Safflower oil, I think, is available to the public in Australia. Only minor amounts of things like safflower or flax oil in most other Western countries.
And what are the advantages of plant-based oils compared to things like, I remember, you know, people cooking in lard or any other kinds of things like that?
Right. And trying to avoid some of the fad too overly broad sweeping statements that you referred to earlier, I'll try to confine my remarks, you know, appropriately. In general, the advantages of cooking with plant oils over animal oils, again, this is generally speaking, is you tend to have a lower saturated fat content in the plant oils, blander effect on not as much change to the flavor of the underlying food. And nowadays is cited as something that a lot of chefs want. Let the food's flavor come through rather than being masked by it. I've been in overseas countries where I'm in a restaurant and suddenly I can tell it was cooked with lard and it's very distinctive. And lard is so rarely used in the U.S. that we sometimes forget how much it masked some of the underlying food flavor.
Yeah, I always could pick it out, particularly in Mexican cooking, when they use it as a basis for even like refried beans. You know, the ones that are made with and without lard have a very different flavor and mouthfeel. And I don't know that I necessarily prefer it. But the big problem with that is really saturated fat. And so for the audience, what is the difference between saturated fat and unsaturated fat?
Sure. And as somebody with a chemistry degree, I can tell you the simple answer, of course, is that saturated fats have no chemical double bonds within their molecular structure. For more the layman, saturated fats, again, this is not true if they're consumed in, you know, tiny amounts. But if consumed to excess, saturated fats can contribute towards obesity, even diabetes and cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, and so back to the idea from at least the chemical, you know, when you start speaking about the chemistry of this, and again, targeted at kind of maybe the more sophisticated listener who's curious about this, is that, you know, the most fundamental unit of the lipid of a fat molecule, it looks almost like a tadpole with a couple of tails. And those tails are made up of carbon atoms that are all held together with either single or double bonds. And it's the a number of double bonds versus the single bonds that may be in different places in that molecule, in that tail, that really dictate whether it's saturated, you know, it's all double bonds, or whether there are some that are not. And it's just that very simple chemistry of the tail of that molecule that changed the way it's metabolized and even its fate inside the body and that could have health impacts. So what about monounsaturated fats? How do those fit into this?
Right. So the monounsaturated fat, certainly of greatest relevance to this conversation, is the oleic fatty acid. Oleic acid is, just as was said, monounsaturated. So in its chemical structure, there's only one double bond. This results in it being quite stable to resist breakdown from either high heat, such as in frying, or oxidation, as in, you know, foods going stale after they've set out for a while. So in addition to that, again, in general, when consumed, even in excess, they really don't contribute toward the aforementioned diseases like cardiovascular disease, atherosclerosis, or diabetes.
And could you speak a little bit more to the role of fats in food preparation or as an ingredients and the relative stability of the different kinds of oils? I know that when you have a fryer, for instance, that different types of saturation really change its properties in a fryer and the number of times you can use it. And then also in food itself, like, or I shouldn't just say in food, in any ingredient, even if it's cosmetics or whatever, that they're, time before they, in the word that they usually throw out there, go rancid, can be related to that kind of oil quality. Can you give us an idea about that?
Right. So around the world, there are a lot of erroneous beliefs about shelf life and going rancid, which in general is just oxidation of the double bonds we mentioned. So the if we confine ourselves to the unsaturated fats, as was mentioned, since it only has one double bond in the molecule, oleic acid is the least likely to spoil or break down quickly, whether from heat or oxidation. On the other end of the scale would be linolenic acid, which is present in most plant oils, and that has three double bonds. So it's called an N3 or omega-3 fatty acid. Yes, if you treat it badly, so in other words, if you store it at too high of a temperature, or if you expose it to sunlight, that you don't keep it in the pantry with the door closed, you can have the oils that contain quite a bit of linolenic, the omega-3 I mentioned, go rancid rather quickly. And that's really, though, a thing of the past in the United States. Most food preparers have proper storage now. They know that a bottle of soybean oil, for instance, just like numerous other ingredients they use, should be kept at, you know, room temperature or maybe slightly cooler in the dark, so that it doesn't, you know, photo degrade. And that, along with modern refining methods, and at least in my house, we routinely have bottles of soybean oil that stay fine for a year when stored in such conditions.
Yeah, likewise. Oil lasts a long time by us, and in different oils for different applications. And we'll cover that back on the other side of the break. But you mentioned this thing of omega-3. When you talk about plant oils and you hear omega-3, omega-6, omega-9, and even fish oils, what is that omega-3 number referring to again?
Again, it's been misused and subject to a lot of fads over the years. So omega-3 refers to fatty acids that chemists call N3 oils because they have three double bonds within the molecular chain that comprises that fatty acid. So yes, it's slightly more prone to oxidation, but all of these omega-3s or N3s impart health benefits when consumed. And so, for instance, linolenic acid, again, present in many of the plant oils, not in any animal oils, is an omega-3 that you actually can put a heart label health claim on it. So soybean oil in the U.S. can have two different labels approved by the FDA that cite the fact that it's better for you when consumed in terms of heart health benefits. Europe and most other Western nations also allow a health label claim for linolenic acid containing foods. Again, it's subject to, you know, minimum amounts, et cetera. But I'd like to point out that it's not just the omega-3 content of what you eat all on its own. More important is the ratio. So, for instance, the ratio of the N3 or omega-3 in a given oil to the N2 or linoleic is the most common N2 fatty acid in the U.S. diet. Just as you can imagine from what was discussed earlier, that's because it has two double bonds in its fatty acid chain molecular diagram. But the human body can readily convert linolenic into the so-called fish oil fatty acids, DHA and EPA. But that is hindered if there is an excess in the diet of linoleic acid. So unfortunately, in the U.S. diet, we tend to have a ratio of 10 to 1 or even higher. And that slows down the body's ability to convert linolenic into the fish oil fatty acids. But in at least one of the high oleic oils that we're about to talk about in a few minutes, the ratio is actually 1 to 1. And then the body rapidly converts them to the fish oil fatty acids, again known as DHA or docosahexaenoic acid, EPA, eicosapentaenoic acid.
So really the thing we want to be shooting for then is finding foods or finding oils that have a higher oleic content, because that oleic content is the one that's most convertible to the ones that have the ultimately the endpoint health effects inside the body, right? So that's where we step off.
Yes. Yeah, so all of the high oleic oils, you have a concomitant decrease in linoleic content as you increase the oleic content. And that's because they're on the same biochemical synthesis pathway within the plant. High oleic oils are made by down-regulating the desaturase enzyme that normally would convert some of the oleic to linoleic, and then that's even further to linolenic. But by down-regulating the relevant enzymes, you wind up with a far healthier oil in which much of the linoleic is instead replaced by oleic. And that ratio I mentioned is far closer to the ideal, which is 4 to 1 or even a smaller ratio.
Now, we know you work with the soybean industry and the soybean folks, but if you look across all the oils that are out there from corn and canola, and what are the differences in terms of just as they are naturally with that linolenic or linoleic to oleic ratio? And are they all about the same, or is there one or the other that gives you a little different profile?
No, they are by no means the same. So, for instance, sunflower oil has virtually zero linolenic in it. Corn oil, the same, virtually zero linolenic in it. So the ratios there are you know, not going to help you as far as getting toward that ideal ratio. Some that naturally contain significant amounts of linolenic are soybean at 8% linolenic and canola at 10.
Okay, that really helps a lot in understanding how this can work. So when we get back from the break, we'll talk about how this is done in the modern engineered plants and in the plants that are giving rise to plenish oils. We're speaking with Kim Nill. He's the Director of Market Development at the Minnesota Soybean Research and Development Council, and we'll be back with more Talking Biotech podcast in just a minute.
Greetings, Talking Biotech aficionados, and thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Thanks to you. You've written great, wonderful reviews on iTunes, and it's quite a beacon to the podcast surfer. Shows your amazing support for this mofo of a science show. And special thanks to you who dared to accept my challenge and got that Talking Biotech tattoo. It's appreciated, but guess what? That tattoo lasts a really long time. It's my hope that someday, a few decades from now, we can look at your dermal commitment to a science podcast and ridicule you for defacing your flesh. Our hope is that your days in assisted living will use that tat as a conversation starter, reminding the elderly of the dark ages when science was shunned for flashy marketing and myth that placed fear over reason. However, with the support of so many listeners, we're moving innovation to application and helping people and planet along the way. So tell a friend, write a review on iTunes, and most of all, share the beautiful science that we learn from the expert guests that kindly share their expertise here on the Talking Biotech podcast.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech podcast. Today we're speaking with Kim Nill. He's the Director of Market Development for the Minnesota Soybean Research and Development Council. And we're talking about the development of high oleic soybean oils. And it's been an area of interest for me for a long time, because if I have my choice between which oil to choose, choosing the one which may have the best performance in cooking as well as potential health benefits really is a good move. And so understanding what these are, what these different oils are, is something that all of us should really consider. Now, to get there, there's been some interesting genetic tweaks that have been done in order to get plants that produce the higher oleic oil content. And so if we go, first of all, I guess, you know, what you mentioned before, you're at about 8% in soybean. What's the target? Where do you want to be with the amount of oleic oil inside that that content?
Well, the answer actually comes down to it depends what you're going to use the oil for. So, for instance, in what we call in the industry salad oils, in other words, just that at a restaurant, for instance, simply sprinkled or dumped onto your salad, depending on your preferences, then the answer would be you would want the linolenic, the omega-3 content, as high as possible, okay? So for such a use, conventional soybean oil is great because it doesn't, as I mentioned earlier, doesn't mask the underlying taste of the ingredients of the salad, and it has 8% linolenic content, so a good omega-3 content. Now, if you're intending to do really high heat frying and you don't care about whether you get that golden brown sort of look and wonderful taste, as in the ideal French fry or fried chicken, then you'd go with something like Plenish, which is 75% oleic content. You're literally going for as high of oleic content and as low just about everything else as possible. Because for potato chips, the manufacturers, they want heat stability so they can fry at a super high temp and no oxidation risk.
I see. I might have misspoke earlier then, because I said it was at 8% oleic, but actually it's 8% linolenic. Was that correct?
Yes. Conventional soybean oil is at 8% linolenic.
Okay. So I made a little bit of a mistake there. So those of you who didn't catch that originally, go back and, you know, I don't want to fix it, because just spontaneously it shows how confusing this can be.
Sure.
But now we start looking at something like Plenish. What was done with the plants to be able to skew their metabolism to produce the higher amounts of the desired oil?
Okay, we count at least four different commercialized high oleic soybean oils so far, and they each used a different methodology. In the case of Plenish, they used antisense insertion of a gene. It's a relatively older method within biotechnology, but what you then get is co-suppression. So suppressed the FAD gene that produces the desaturase enzyme I mentioned earlier, that thus greatly limits the plant's conversion from oleic to subsequent products, linoleic or linolenic. And that's what elevates the oil in Plenish soybeans to up to 75% oleic content versus the normal 23% in conventional soybean oil.
I see. So that one's with antisense. It's been done in some other ways too, hasn't it?
Yes. For instance, a company in Minnesota named Calixt recently used one of the first gene editing type tools known as TALENs. In using that, they again downregulated the FAD gene and thus again greatly reduced the amount of desaturase enzyme present.
Well, I'm really glad you mentioned that, because it was a TALEN-based gene editing event that was done by Calix, as you mentioned, but with Dan Voitis in episode 108 of the Talking Biotech series, we talked to him about that. And it's a good one for folks to go back to if they want more technical background on that particular issue. The nice thing about that one is that there's not a lot of unusual regulatory loops to jump through, because it mimics a natural mutation in the gene. So it allows this high oleic soybean without going through a lot of the regulatory mess that you would if you, like they did with the antisense, I'm sure.
Yes.
But are there any other ways they've done this other than the antisense and TALEN?
Yeah, so University of Missouri, the researchers would have been Grover Shannon and Kristen Bilyeu, did it with conventional plant breeding. And there what they did was they got a doubling up of some of the relevant FAD genes in order to, without the use of either gene editing or transgenics, they were able to impart, again, in the high 70% to almost 80% oleic acid. And that was, again, one that by all definitions is conventional plant breeding developed. Some of the alleles they used were found in germplasm collections, but they also used at least one that was done via mutagenesis.
Well, it's really interesting how that you can get to the same endpoint by all these different roads. And really just thinking about the gene editing one, since that's always a hot topic here on the podcast, how much of the oil comes from gene edited plants? Are those widely in distribution at this point?
Not yet. So to give you an idea of the relative acreages, during 2018, 350,000 acres of Plenish were grown in the Midwestern U.S., and of that, in comparison to that, the Calix gene editing one was at approximately 16,000 acres. it's because of its relative newness. So, for instance, for 2019, Calix predicts it will double the acreage of that soybean, and there's little reason to believe it won't rapidly increase in acreage in the future.
That's really good. I've been following them with a lot of excitement because they were using this, you know, CRISPR-Cas9 steals the show when we talk about gene editing. But here's a great example of this TALEN-based approach, which really does a comparable job. And I'm really glad that these products are starting to hit the market because it really opens the door for a lot more innovation, especially from small companies and universities where we previously couldn't compete in the transgenic part because of the huge amounts of regulation we have to deal with. If you look at, I guess the next real question for you is, if we look across, let's just say Plenish oil, what is the composition of that with respect to, and you mentioned, you know, the oleic levels are higher, and what is the exact composition of all of the oils that are present inside that that particular product?
Well, in the Plenish soybean, you have 2% linolenic. They greatly reduced that. 75% to 76% oleic, 8% linoleic, and then the saturated fat content is 12% versus 15 in conventional soybean oil.
So overall, it makes a healthier oil. And how about, you know, we may have kind of touched on this before, but I'd really like to drive it home, mostly for my own clarification, is how would you expect it to be performed differently in, you mentioned before, as a salad oil, but how about in frying and things like that?
Well, the Plenish oil lasts 2 to 3 times longer in a restaurant fryer or an industrial fryer than would, for instance, conventional soybean oil. Again, the far greater oleic content of Plenish imparts far greater heat resistance. So the oil doesn't, you know, break down and turn a darker color. You don't have that gunky polymer buildup on the equipment. And most importantly of all, since you don't have thermal breakdown, the foods coming out of it for, again, that 3 times longer frying period still have that wonderful taste.
And maybe from the standpoint, you know, the word sustainability always comes up. If you're able to make your oil last 3 times longer, are you really looking at a better sustainability? Because that stuff has to be disposed of and you have to grow the plants to make it. So is this really a big step forward in terms of sustainability?
Plenish has been an enormous step forward in sustainability. You're not wasting that massive amount of heat that is lost if you've ever seen it done in the back of a restaurant. They have to turn off the fryer, you know, say once a week when they use other oils, wait for it to cool, you know, then dispose of that oil, which itself, you know, has an environmental cost. But the energy is lost, you know, literally they have to let it cool down so the worker isn't injured. Then they have to spend an hour or so with tools literally chipping that polymerized gunk off of the fryer equipment. All of that is done away with when they switch to Plenish soybean oil. You don't have that polymer buildup. Again, you're only shutting it down and replacing the oil 1/3 as many times. And it's been calculated in a recently published paper, there's an almost 30% increase in what's called the life cycle assessment efficiency. In other words, a reduction of adverse environmental impacts for this switch to Plenish high oleic soybean oil.
I wish I would have had this back in the 80s when I was dropping chimichangas into a fryer, because that cleaning the fryers and all of the grease traps, it was the most disgusting job in a restaurant. And, you know, anything you can do on that front is a big step forward. But what about for farmers? Is this trait or these traits, are they available in different kinds of soybeans that are present around the nation? I mean, soybean isn't one thing, right? It's many different genetic packages. And what kind of variation is available there?
Right. So for the conventional soybeans, to give you an idea, over 1,000 different soybean varieties are grown across the United States. They differ by latitude, the local plant disease challenge, soil type, annual rainfall. Farmers select among those many soybean varieties to optimize to their local microclimate and soil conditions. Because it's relatively newer, there are fewer varieties of Plenish soybeans out there, but at least 20 are available today. It's grown from Maryland in the east all the way to Nebraska in the west. We are now growing it in the southern half of Minnesota and then all the way down to Missouri.
And I guess along the same line, how does that work with on-farm economics? I mean, do the seeds cost more and do they get a premium for it, or how does that break down?
The seeds would cost about the same as any other biotech seed that they're going to plant instead. Certainly on the East Coast, they have reported that the yields are as good or better than the other alternative soybean varieties they have. In some of the northern climates, again, they're still working to make the yield comparable, but they're getting close. And then when the time comes to sell it, in general, they get 40 to 50 cent per bushel price premium because there is additional work involved. The farmer has to very carefully plant it separately, grow it separately, deliver it to the crushing facility separately, et cetera. And there are some additional costs to that. But by and large, the premiums are enough to more than compensate them for that extra effort.
I guess this is maybe a question I should have asked earlier, but we were talking about a plant and you're changing its lipid profile. And, you know, lipids are important to organisms. And is this changing the oil production just in the seed, you know, the quality just in the seed, or does this change it in the whole plant? And are there other collateral effects of changing a plant's lipid chemistry?
Well, in the case of Plenish, we can answer that it's strictly in the seed. And that's because as a transgenic product subject to a lot of regulation, they actually had to assess those very questions. So they know the change was only in the oil, in the seed, the rest of the plant totally unaffected. No change in lipid profile.
I always love a good biotech innovation, and I love something that can give farmers more choices, maybe higher profits, and can give a better product for consumers, especially in healthful food. And how much has the public got excited about this? And the reason I ask that is because, you know, here I am, a guy who gets excited about such innovations, and I never saw it on my store shelves, you know, kind of figured it wasn't available. And, you know, now we're talking about it. I received a bottle in the mail, and it's real. It's a thing. How much is the public excited about this, and how much have the relevant companies really played this up?
Well, the product is still being, you know, introduced, still being rolled out. Part of the effort involved in it was done by what's called the United Soybean Board. And this is a board of farmers that administers sort of a self-imposed tax that soybean farmers in America voted on themselves to promote their products. So they haven't got it to nationwide distribution yet. But in the Midwest states where it has been distributed, we've certainly seen a lot of excitement here in Minnesota, especially for one fryer restaurants, to name one category. You know, when that fryer is down, you know, to cool off, be degunked and whatever, they're not making money in a one fryer restaurant. And they are just ecstatic when they see that they can, you know, reduce their changeover of oil by 2/3.
And so if people do want to try it or do want to, you know, you can order a bottle online, apparently, but where can they find it?
Again, the United Soybean Board and the relevant seed company, now known as Corteva, they have focused not on the retail sector. You know, you can argue maybe they should have, but they thought it would be faster and more cost effective to go to like the big fryers like Kentucky Fried Chicken or other big restaurant chains. We up in Minnesota said, hey, you know, can we kind of also, you know, promote it to our local rural restaurants, knowing that, you know, a lot of them have only one fryer. And proportionally, it's actually far more valuable to them economically, you know, than the larger chains. And so we've been doing that. So it's a little of both. And you haven't seen it in Florida because, well, there's basically not much of a Florida soybean industry. So they don't have somebody like me down there promoting it and carrying it from restaurant to restaurant and trying to sell people on it.
Yeah, I guess we don't have that, but we got a lot of old people. And we have and we have this population that's growing by 7,000 people a week. And you have people who are looking at their, you know, their blood chemistries and thinking about the oil they choose. And we're the third largest state. And I just in terms of, you know, my optics on this from a guy who's been watching biotech for 30 years and watching it sometimes fall over its own feet, that, you know, the minute that we can provide something to the consumer that they see the benefit, and if they can see the frying is better and know that, you know, in their heart, it's something that's working better for them in terms of their health, I think that that is a way to really, you know, drive the acceptance of this as a really legitimate way to affect the chemistries that affect our chemistries. And so, you know, I hope to see it available soon. And I think this podcast could generate quite a bit of interest, especially among science enthusiasts. But it, it can be purchased online somewhere. I mean, is there some sort of a retail face that you could point us to?
Yes, they can purchase it at the online store of Minnesota Soybean if they wish. And that web address is mnsoybean.org. Recall that MN is the postal abbreviation for Minnesota.
So what's the best way for people to get in touch with you or with this kind of a product? Is there, you know, maybe an email address that would be particularly good?
Yes, they could email me at the address KIM as in Mary and then mnsoybean.com.
Perfect. So really, really nice. So Kim Nill, you know, this is really exciting and really great to hear about this product. I've had questions about it forever and I really feel like I'm up to speed now. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And once again, thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Tell a friend about the podcast and the innovations we discuss. Write a review on iTunes. We've got a lot of them up there. And right now, when there's so much podcast content available, having more good reviews really says we have something going on here that you're finding useful. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review of this podcast on iTunes and recommend it to a friend. More downloads help us reach a wider audience with science.